Hey there, I'm Jeremy with Good Beer Matters. First, thank you for listening to the Good Beer Matters podcast, where we explore the craft and culture of beer. Second, I want to see the beer and hospitality industries improve so we can do a better job, make more money, and so guests can have exceptional experiences. Good Beer Matters is dedicated to the pros and enthusiasts in the beer industry because we are the ones who will make it better. To that end, I want to invite you to subscribe to my monthly newsletter where I share perspectives on beer, styles, pairing, and some practical beer education. Go to goodbeermatters.net to subscribe. My name is Jeremy, and this is Good Beer Matters.
Beer is the best form of alcohol in terms of combination of functional benefits and safety. There's social support, and you're simultaneously getting these other benefits like stress reduction, creativity enhancement. Humans want beauty, we want complexity, we want taste. We can't live on just bread and water.
Why do we humans crave alcohol so much? Is it the flavor, the effect, or both? What purpose could this possibly serve for our evolution and our culture? My next guest is a professor and author who has answered all these questions. So, grab a beer and let's get to class. We find great experiences at the intersection of craft and culture. These are the stories of us, of great food and the beer that brings it all together. For the craft and culture of beer, this is episode 135 of Good Beer Matters with Professor Ted Slingerland.
Well, today we get to talk about the collision of beer and culture, beer and humanity, beer and history, and all that stuff that just kind of geeks me out on stuff. I mean, yes, we love to just drink a beer, we love to taste a beer, but there's so much more behind it, and every guest I have on the show agrees that there's so much more behind the beer. And today we're going to take a look at what's behind the beer. Dr. Edward Slingerland, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Just for a quick background, just a quick orientation, kind of lay of the land. Tell us a little bit about your background, and especially kind of evolve it around to, you know, how we're dealing with beer or by extent just alcohol.
Yeah, it's a strange topic for me to write on. My background is in Sinology, so I study early China, early Chinese philosophy and religion. My PhD is in religious studies, so I do comparative religion and cognitive science of religion, evolutionary approaches to religion. And that's actually really where the book Drunk came from, was I'm interested in why people do things that are costly and seem puzzling unless you have some evolutionary story about it. And so I began, I basically asked this question about religion originally. So why do cultures that, you know, spend 30% of their GDP to build massive underground tombs and then just bury all the wealth in the ground, why do they not get outcompeted by cultures that use that money to build aqueducts and city walls? Why do people who spend, you know, cut off the foreskin of their penis and forego delicious foods and spend, you know, a good chunk of their day doing rituals, why do they not get outcompeted by people who just do practical stuff? It's a puzzle. And what the answer to that puzzle in the case of religion is that these otherwise puzzling, costly behaviors have some role to play in allowing humans to cooperate on a large scale. And so I basically just turned that same lens to the question of why we like to drink alcohol, because it's, I think, an identical evolutionary puzzle. It's a costly behavior, but it's ancient, it's ubiquitous. And so there's got to be, you know, the standard stories in scientifically are that our taste for alcohol is an evolutionary mistake. It's just a hijack of reward systems, or there's some other misfiring that's happening. And I just don't think that can be the case, given how ancient and ubiquitous our relationship with alcohol is.
Yeah. One of the things I share with people is, and you know, granted, we can extend this to alcohol just period, but I'm going to talk about beer because the podcast is Good Beer Matters. But I say that beer is something that no one needs, but everyone wants. And so much so that, you know, if from my own experience, you know, I would have been smarter if I had become a contractor, had I been become a banker, had I mean, if anything, had I gotten into wine, there's more money in wine than there is beer. Yeah. You know, if you want, I mean, you just look at the tap room versus the chateau. I mean, you know, it's clear and evident, but for some reason I was drawn into this world of beer, initially against my will. And now I just kind of, you know, embraced it, but here we are. We're so kind of maniacally overtaken by this substance once again that no one needs but everyone wants. So before we kind of dive into that topic, and you brought up the religion, and I want to touch on that too because I find that super interesting. Being religious, but there's also the just the Bible specifically that it warns against drunkenness, but there's the first miracle and there's the Last Supper, you know, and we so there's like wait a minute, what am I missing here?
There's the Eucharist, right? I mean, it's a sacred substance. So,
So before, I just wanted to kind of line that up as a little bit of a tease, but I do want to toss the softball back to you. Tell us more about your book, Drunk. I mean, you kind of just referenced it in what it means to your work, but let's just talk about the book. Who's it for and what are they going to get out of it?
So it basically is an attempt to answer this question of why do we like to drink? And the kind of easy but shallow answer to that, that's not really an answer, is, well, it makes us feel good, right? Yeah. That's the stat people say. But that really doesn't answer the question. The deeper question is, why does evolution allow it to make us feel good? Given the fact that alcohol is very costly. It's physiologically costly. It's economically costly to produce. You look around cultures like ancient Sumer. It's estimated they took at least a half of their grain production went into beer. Mm-hmm. So they're taking half of their foodstuffs and turning it into a low grade liquid neurotoxin. That's puzzling. Right? Yeah. It has these physiologically harmful effects. If you have any kind of propensity to alcoholism, it could be a very dangerous substance for you. So I was very unsatisfied with the current scientific answers to the question of why we like to drink, which were all, as I said, evolutionary mistake stories.
Yeah.
The dominant one, if you open a Psych 101 textbook, it's going to tell you that ethanol hijacks a reward circuit in the brain. It's just like cocaine or something else. We figured out that we can press this lever and get a reward. And the problem with that is evolution allows that kind of stuff to happen if either it's very recent. So like our taste for junk food is clearly an evolutionary mistake.
Right? Clearly. I'll agree with that.
and it's because it's a relatively recent thing, right? So getting enough fat and sugar has always been a problem for us historically. It's only recently that we have, you know, 7-Elevens and McDonald's and we can eat to the point of obesity. So that's a relatively recent problem, even though it's costly. So, you know, obesity, diabetes are very dangerous. We also have evolutionary hijacks that are ancient and ubiquitous. They've been around for a long time, but they don't cost very much. And so the example I start the book with is masturbation, right? We figure out that we can get this reward. We can hijack this reward network that originally evolved to reward reproductive sex. That's what evolution wants us to do, is pass on our genes. But we figured out ways to get that same reward for wildly non-reproductive acts. We engage in them quite aptly. And in this case, it's evolution lets us get away with it because it doesn't cost very much. The basic system, reward system, does its job, or we wouldn't be here to talk about it. And my argument in the book is that our taste for alcohol isn't like either of those vices, if you want to think of it as a vice. It's not like our taste for junk food, in that it's ancient and is all over the world, all throughout history. And unlike our propensity to masturbate and try to get an orgasm for whatever technique we want to use, it's very costly. So something else must be going on. So if you've got these clear costs, you've got physiological costs, you've got economic costs, from an evolutionary, as an evolutionary thinker, I'm then looking for what's in the other column, what's in the benefit column that's paying for those costs. And so the bulk of the book in the beginning, I kind of debunk the evolutionary mistake stories and explain why they can't be true. And then I walk through what the benefits of alcohol have been for us historically, both at an individual and social level. So, you know, there's a variety of them, ranging from very simple things like just stress, anxiety reduction, to quite important high-level things like group innovation and group cooperation. So basically, this is a book about the human species, Homo sapiens, and our weirdness as a species, how we're unusual, we're very like other species, and why part of our unusualness is that we need cultural tools like beer in order to cooperate on a large scale and to succeed as a species.
Yeah. And so I haven't finished reading your book. I'm still most of the way through, but you talk about, you know, when we discover a tool, when we invent a tool, we're forever changed, you know, and like alcohol is the prime reason this, but, you know, I think about fire. You know, we use fire to cook, we use fire to keep ourselves warm, but fire can also be horrifically destructive. I think about a baseball bat. You know, I could be a 10-year-old little leaguer and I hit the home running, the game winning home run, and I'm a hero, or I take it to bash my ex's bumper because, you know, she cheated on me or something. Right. You know, it's just like, it's a tool that could be used for either things. And alcohol, beer seems to be one of those tools that for, you know, there's equal risk, there's equal reward, but for some reason we have this tool and we are forever changed. Unpack how that has affected our human evolution just by discovering that tool of alcohol.
Yeah. So the fire analogy is a good one to bring up because it's a good example of how we're completely dependent on tools like fire. So, and we've become physiologically dependent on them. So our jaws, our teeth, our digestive system has changed to adapt to eating cooked food. So humans cannot, unlike chimpanzees, we can't live on raw meat and raw food anymore because we don't have the jaws, we don't have the digestive system. So we've actually changed physiologically to adapt to a tool because no one, you know, fire is an invention. No kid has a genetic ability to make fire. We figure it out. So we are completely dependent on tools and we adapt to become even more dependent on them. And so alcohol has been, what I argue in the book is, as a species, we face this tension. We are primates and we have a lot, our basic biology and our kind of basic drives are not that different from our primate cousins. So chimpanzees, other apes. And yet we live, if you look at how humans live today, we look more like social insects. You know, you just look at a city. It looks like a, you know, an ant colony. It's we cooperate on this massive scale and with an intensity that looks a lot like social insects, even though we're biologically primates. And so I talk about this puzzle of how you get the square primate peg into this round social insect hole. It doesn't seem to fit because we should biologically just be cooperating with relatives and people we know well. And yet we cooperate with strangers all the time, even in very intense ways, like, you know, being in the army and giving up our life, you know, for other people. So there's various cultural technologies we've used to allow that transformation to happen, to turn us into kind of domesticated, cooperating social insects. And one of them is religion. So religious practices and beliefs help us to do this. But another one is alcohol. One of the functions of alcohol, of the many, is to simultaneously, when we cooperate, we often face these cooperation dilemmas where you and I do best if we trust each other and we both contribute to the common good. If we do that, we actually end up being selfishly better off in the end. The problem is when we do that, we become vulnerable to what economists call perfection. So if I trust you, I'm now vulnerable to you betraying me and you getting all the benefit and me taking all the cost. Rational agents have trouble. These are in game economic terms are sometimes called prisoner dilemma situations where you need to cooperate to do well. We solve prisoner dilemmas all the time. And one of the ways we do it is by using alcohol. So alcohol simultaneously makes it harder for me to lie. So one of the main functions of ethanol is to downregulate the prefrontal cortex. So it's the center of cognitive control in your brain. It's what allows you to keep multiple things in your mind at once, to suppress instincts, to stay focused on a task, to do abstract reasoning. It's also the key to lying successfully. If I'm going to tell you something that's not true, I've got to keep in my mind both what I'm telling you and what I know to be actually the case. I need to keep those two things separate. I need to make sure that my facial expressions and my behavior and my tone of voice all fit the thing I'm telling you is true, not the thing I know is true. So that's very PFC heavy, prefrontal cortex heavy operation.
Hey there, it's me, Jeremy again. I forgot to mention that I also have a podcast with my dear friend, the incredible Julia Herz. Together, we've created the Sense of Beer Style podcast. It's the essential training for those who want to lead in food and beverage. We've created prepisodes to cover foundational beer knowledge, as well as Stylecast to walk you through each category of the 2021 BJCP Beer Style Guidelines. If you work with beer as part of your job, then subscribe and listen so you can become an authority. Go to senseofbeerstyle.com to subscribe.
If you could go in and knock the PFC out, you suddenly made it very difficult for people to lie. And so one of the functions of alcohol is it's a lie detector substance, or it just impairs
people. And it's equally as effective and with less damage than a baseball bat.
Exactly. Yeah. Or a transcranial magnet. And then simultaneously, it's one of the other functions of ethanol is that it is boosting the production of these kind of feel-good chemicals, serotonin, endorphin. So it's not only making it harder for me to deceive you, it's making me not want to deceive you. It's making me feel like you're great. I'm great. You're great. We're all great together. You know, these hormones are things that bind people together. Alcohol is also stimulating those. So you get this, you get kind of stimulation of pro-social feelings through the release of these chemicals. And you get the reduction of the ability to cheat or deceive.
Yeah. And so this and is I was going to say, oxytocin is one of those too, right? The bonding drug, where the more oxytocin, the more I'm just like, you and I are one, man. You know?
Yeah. I love you, man. You're the best, right? And I feel really good about myself too, right? It's so that's why I argue that, you know, whenever you see strangers or people with potentially different interests who have to come to an agreement, they have to sit down and get past their differences and figure out what they're going to do, alcohol comes out, right? Every treaty meeting, any diplomatic meeting, I argue this is why when Skype was invented, we were told business travel was going to disappear, because why would you get on a plane and fly to Shanghai to sign a contract when you could just do what we're doing right now, right? Do it over your computer. And yet it took a global pandemic to have any impact on business travel. People kept traveling. And that's because if I'm doing anything more complicated than buying paper clips from you, I want to know that I can trust you. I want to know what kind of person you are. And the only way you find that out is to fly to Shanghai and sit down in a restaurant and eat a meal and drink alcohol together. So it's this tool we use to overcome potential suspicion and to create group bonds that are bigger than just the family or the immediate friend network.
You know, there was a tradition. It's been a long time since I've been in college, but I remember taking a class on native and tribal cultures and kind of studied African and South American in the Pacific. But one of the things, if I remember this correctly, is one of the native traditions was when you first greet a visitor, you offer them, you know, you make sure they're comfortable, offer them food, offer them drink, and then you discuss business. Whereas we, at least in the US or in Western cultures, we're like, nope, we're going to have our business meeting first and then we'll go have a bite and a beer. Is that related to this idea of first let's commune and become, you know, come together and then we'll hash out our deal or our differences? Is that the same idea?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And what's interesting is in the Pacific, there are parts of the Pacific where they don't have alcohol. And there's a couple different theories about why that is that I explore in the book. But what's interesting is in the rare cultures that don't have alcohol. So this is parts of the Pacific, North America, interestingly, didn't have alcohol.
Yeah.
You get another drug filling that gap, functional gap. So in the Pacific, it's kava, this tuber that you can ferment that has very similar effects to alcohol. And in North America, it was tobacco, very powerful tobacco mixed with hallucinogens, mild hallucinogens. So that's what, you know, the peace pipe is an intoxicant. And they functionally are having a very similar effect to alcohol. They're downregulating the PFC and they're pumping up these prosocial chemicals. So to me, it's very revealing that when you take alcohol out of the picture, something else has to take its place, which suggests that there's a real important function there that's being served.
And it seems to me, I feel like I should ask this question first. I'm sorry. And this will kind of tag into what we're already talking about. But, you know, we know about the downside of alcohol, especially too much alcohol, vulnerability, violence or unwanted pregnancies, you know, all the effects of alcohol. Right. But somewhere along the line, and, you know, when I trace back the history of beer, I mean, we've traced it back to 13,000 years last I checked, maybe even longer. Where does our human need for intoxication, for altered states come from in the first place? Is it just this, I want to bond with you in the quickest way possible, or is there something deeper there?
There's also, I talked a little bit about this in the book, we seem to seem to have a need for a vacation from ourselves. So we like to lose ourselves, and we can do that in a variety of ways. We can do that in games. So when you play, you know, you really get involved in a game, you lose yourself into the game, you lose a little sense of yourself.
I can relate.
This happens in dancing, group festivals, rituals. It also happens when you consume intoxicants. I mean, one of the things that's happening, you downregulate the PFC, you start to depattern the brain, and your normal sense of self starts to dissolve a bit, or at least get attenuated. And for whatever reason, and there's a lot of debate about why humans need this so much, but we seem to really like it. We seem to have a regular need for it. So, you know, alcohol is doing a lot of different things. It's serving these individual functions like this escape from the self, just plain stress reduction. So, you know, the beer at the end of a work day is something that's universal. And it's because it helps us make that transition from being very PFC focused, get the job done, work on this, this is our task, to relaxing. I'm home now, it's leisure time. And then it also has, it ramps up creativity. So another of the main functions that I look at is how alcohol helps with creative, both individual creativity and group innovation. So making everybody individually more creative, but then also allowing them to share ideas more freely. So it seems to be a crucial tool for group innovation. So it's hitting a bunch of these functions all at the same time. And that's why, you know, at least 13,000 years ago, we were producing and consuming beer way before agriculture.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
And that makes sense. I mean, we're both adults. We both have children. So that, that need for a quick break, I totally get. Anyone listening or watching, they're like, yeah, I gotcha. And in my past, and you know, there's lots of different ways we could do this, it seems to me, but you mentioned like sports. I used to lose myself in sports. I used to lose myself in music. These days I meditate and I free dive. And so that's a great way for me to just kind of deregulate my nervous system. Yeah. Or even quicker and even more efficiently, I can have a beer or two and now I'm instantly deregulated, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, there's lots of ways we can do this. Even. Yeah. No, you know, extreme exercise can do. So there's lots of ways to get the same effect of alcohol through other paths. Extreme exercise, sleep deprivation, pain, intense pain can do it. So there are, I talked a little bit at one point in the book about religious groups that for whatever reason ban alcohol. And what you see in those groups is they figure out other ways to get to that same place. You know, so the Sufis dance all night and sleep deprivation and exercise and rhythm kind of get them in the same place. Other groups just engage in painful, you know, long painful rituals that can get you to the same place. So there are other ways you can do it. It's just that alcohol is so easy. It's like really, it's just easier, you know.
And frankly, it tastes better than a ice bath. So you know.
yeah. So there are definitely other ways to get the same functions, but we haven't invented a technology that's as good as alcohol at doing this.
Well, and one of the things you talk about too, I found interesting is, you know, okay, for those of us who are like, yes, I'm just going to use this intoxicant to kind of regulate my stress and take the edge off the hard parts of life. And we've been doing that for thousands of years. But you also mentioned that alcohol is the best or the most efficient, I forget your wording, but considering all the intoxicants out there, I think you mentioned that alcohol is the better one to use. Mm-hmm. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so alcohol has some downsides. The two main problems with it are that it's physically really addictive. It's like up there with heroin and, you know, other nicotine. And it's physiologically harmful. It damages your liver, it raises your cancer risk. And so it has these downsides. So alcohol is not the perfect drug. It's got two main drawbacks. One is that it's physically very addictive. So it's up there with heroin and nicotine in terms of how you can get physically hooked on it. And it's also physiologically harmful. So it raises your cancer risk, it harms your liver. It's not, you know, there's been, the alcohol industry has always been trumpeting this kind of cholesterol effects. And I wouldn't hang your peg on physiological benefits. It's really, it seems like the net effect of alcohol is negative physiologically. There are other drugs that don't share these drawbacks. So cannabis, we have an ancient history with cannabis. We cultivated it, we domesticated it a long time ago. It has some of the same effects as alcohol, downregulates PFC, it boosts some of the feel-good hormones. And crucially, it's not physically addictive. It could be psychologically addictive, but it's not physically addictive. And it actually seems less harmful physiologically than alcohol. The problem with cannabis, though, is it's got two crucial faults. One is that it has really different effects across individuals. So some people, I had friends in college who would, you know, smoke and then want to talk philosophy or go out dancing. Yeah. And for me, universally, and everyone always says, oh, you haven't tried the right strain, you got to try this type of sativa. It doesn't matter what strain. It just makes me super paranoid and then I want to fall asleep. So it's like, it's the worst social drug. It's a terrible social drug.
I had a buddy in college that whenever he got high, he would basically just start fights, which was like,
you
expect.
So it's unpredictable what it's going to do to a person. Right. And it varies across individuals. That's not good for a social drug. The other problem is it's really hard to dose. So if you're smoking it, you have to know how to hold it in your lungs. If you don't, if we're smoking together and you know how to do that and I don't, we're going to get totally different doses. And if you're eating it, the time lapse between when you consume it and when it comes on has its effects. is notoriously so long that it's really hard to dose, right? People are constantly overdosing on edibles because they eat some, they wait an hour or two, nothing's happening, they take some more, and then suddenly they're like, oh my God, this is horrible. And it lasts for a really long time when you eat it, which also not great. So it's just not, those two flaws mean that it can't take the place of alcohol. Alcohol has very consistent effects across individuals, and it's super easy to dose, especially in a traditional society where what you're drinking is probably some kind of beer that your ancestors made, you grew up around it. You know exactly what a glass of that is going to do to you. And it's going to do it to you, and then it's going to fade. The effects go away very quickly. So we have this machinery in our body that's dedicated to latching on to ethanol and getting it out of our system as quickly as possible. So you can enjoy these social benefits of alcohol for a couple hours, and then they go away. And then you can go back, you know, to do something else. So it's really, and then another, sometimes people say, well, what about psychedelics? You know, there's been interest in like microdosing LSD. And the problem with psychedelics, at least in a traditional form, is they just remove you from reality so wildly that they're not useful as a regular use social drug. You're not going to meet colleagues after work and drop acid, right? It's too powerful. And so maybe in a microdose form, it might be able to be used like alcohol, but we just don't know. It's been, you know, we've had microdosed psychedelics for 5 years or 6 years, maybe. And we've had beer for 13,000. So we have this technology that we know how to use really well. And it just, I don't think it can be replaced by anything that's currently out there.
So then back to the idea of religion. I mean, that's why we want an intoxicant. That's why alcohol is the better intoxicant. I'm going to advocate for beer personally, but I've been known to drink wine and whiskey and other. But, you know, what we started talking at the beginning of this about the idea of religion, and we brought it up again. Some religions don't have alcohol. They have something else that they place it with. And yeah, we mentioned the whole idea of the Bible, and I know other religions where I live, there are a lot of people from Latter-day Saints of religion where they don't drink at all. One of them, you know, I know is a cyclist who goes like 60, 90 mile rides every other day. And it was like, oh, that's where you get it. How do we unpack that idea in a lot of different religions that alcohol is bad, but yet, you know, alcohol is good. You know, how do we navigate through that, find that sweet spot?
Yeah. So some religions ban alcohol. I think in most cases they're banning alcohol for reasons that don't really have to do with alcohol per se. It's a signaling function. So if you want to talk about the Church of the Latter-day Saints, they ban alcohol. They also ban caffeine, right? Mm-hmm. Which doesn't, from a functional perspective, is puzzling. Like caffeine is really useful for social things. And it doesn't have any of the harmful effects of alcohol. They wear funny clothes in some sects, right? So it seems to be in the case of the Mormons and the case arguably of Islam, which was trying to, you know, differentiate itself in the Mediterranean world from these wine drinking cultures around it. It's a way to signal, hey, we're different. We're not like the people around us. So it's signaling something. It's like wearing a hat that's a certain color, right? I'm part of this group. It also is kind of a pain in the ass. Like, it's costly because beer is fun to drink and caffeine is fun to drink. So you're enduring a cost that shows that you actually believe in the group. So I think that in groups that ban alcohol tend to be doing it for signaling and what's called in religious studies, costly display reasons. It's a way of me saying, I really believe in this religion. If I'm willing, you know, in Judaism, I'm willing to, you know, have foreskin of my penis cut off. I really believe this is true.
Solidarity.
Solidarity. And it can't be undone, right? It's scarification and various types of body modifications.
It's kind of like getting jumped into a gang and getting like tattooed or branded or something like that.
It's exactly the same, actually. So get tattoos, scarification. We have all these techniques for both making a costly display because it's unpleasant to get a scar or get tattooed. It's painful. But it also then is a signal to other people that I'm part of this group. So I think that groups that are banning alcohol tend to be doing it for that reason.
Interesting. So one of the things I was curious about, you know, we're talking about religion, but we could talk about religion. We could talk about sports. We could talk about literature, economics, politics. We could talk about humanity. And frankly, you know, back in the college days, I started studying literature and writing, and I really loved it because it was basically the story of humanity as told through this novel or whatever it was. And one day when I finally fell into the rabbit hole of beer, I realized that beer is basically telling that same story of humanity is the way I look at it. When we look at the evolution of beer throughout history and the evolution of our humanity throughout history, what are some of the points in our cultural history that where the beer and our history kind of collide in very profound ways?
Probably around 20 to 15,000 years ago, you get hunter-gatherers who discover how to ferment grains into beer. And you get them then coming together at these sites. Like there's a very famous site called Göbekli Tepe in present-day Turkey, where they have this monumental architecture with this kind of crazy iconography on it. We're not really sure what was going on belief-wise there. What we do know is that hunter-gatherers were coming from all over the region, converging on this site, engaging in some kind of religious rituals, and feasting. So we have the remains of antelope bones, gazelles, so they were feasting on meat, and they were drinking something out of huge vats. And we don't, from this particular site, we don't have chemical residue evidence that it was beer, but it was beer. We know that they were making beer in the region. We have evidence from other sites. We have, you know, we have some festival scenes where humans are dancing with turtles and that doesn't happen on water. So this is sites like this is what caused this movement in archaeology that started in the 1950s, and I think is spread and become more prominent. It's sometimes called the beer before bread hypothesis. So the standard story of our history with beer is that we figured out agriculture first. You know, we made bread and other types of grain products to eat for nutrition purposes. And then one day someone left their sourdough starter out too long and it fermented and they tried it and it tasted good. And so the standard story, in the same way that the standard story is that our taste for alcohol is a mistake, there's also a claim that our relationship with alcohol is a mistake. It was a byproduct of agriculture. It's looking like it's the other way around. So it's looking like humans actually were motivated to start settling down and cultivating crops, not to make bread, but to make beer. And in a way, bread was a byproduct of our desire to drink beer. And you see this not just in the Fertile Crescent, where it's beer that they're making first. If you look at other parts of the world, the first domesticated crops seem to be selected for their psychoactive properties, not for nutrition. So the ancestor. So
can I interject a quick question? Because I remember reading or watching a documentary. I can't remember what it was, but the first crops that we as human beings tried to grow and cultivate as agricultural farmers were different grasses, barley among them. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that those have psychoactive aspects?
When you ferment them into
when
beer.
You ferment them. Got it. Of course, we all know that, but. Okay.
Yeah,
I wanted.
No, it seems it seems like they were
hemp or something.
No, in other parts of the world they were, but that's later.
Okay.
And in South America, the first cultivated crop is maize, so corn. And the ancient ancestor, the wild ancestor to maize, is called teosinte. And it is actually, if you were interested in making grain products, if you wanted to make tortillas, you would ignore teosinte because it doesn't make very good grain. But what it does have is a stalk that's got a lot of starch and sugar in it that you can ferment. And it's the basis of chicha, which is basically the beer that's made in South America. And so it's clear that people notice this plant and sort of focusing on it because they were making it into beer, not because they were trying to make grain products out of it. And again, you see this all over the world. The first cultivated crop seemed to be selected because they were doing something to our minds, not because we needed better nutrition. And so in this sense, there's a sense of which it's literally true that beer created civilization, right? It's our desire to make beer is what motivated us to settle down and start agriculture and start living in these large scale communities. So there's this connection between intoxication and civilization that's really deep. And that really goes back to the beginning of the story of humans living in large-scale societies.
And so that was the beginning of it all. But as we populated the rest of the earth, as we moved to North America and established Europe and Asia, are there other little waypoints where our human culture and the need for beer and intoxicants kind of keep on colliding and kind of, would you say, well, let me ask this, would you say that we affected, the production of beer, or did beer kind of affect our culture? It's kind of a chicken and egg question.
It's bi-directional, right? So the beer is allowing us, is having these effects that allow us to socialize on a certain level that allow us to innovate in a certain way. But then of course we're modifying these crops. We're constantly pushing yeast to get tougher and tougher, right? So historically, most beers probably clocked in at about 2-3% ABV, right? Because natural fermentation, one of the things I argue in Drunk is that alcohol has become more dangerous in the modern world relatively recently because we've disabled a couple safety features that it's always had.
Yeah, thank you for that reminder. I did want to ask you about that. And from that book, you mentioned that if we had just stuck with beer and even wine, everything would have been fine. But somewhere along the way, someone said, "Hey, I've got a new tool that's going to affect us profoundly. It's called a distiller."
Yeah,
unpack that story for us.
Yeah. So alcohol comes with a built-in safety feature, which is the limits of natural fermentation. So historically, I mean, we've been breeding these super tough yeasts, so we can make pretty alcoholic beers and wines now. But typically, beers would clock in at 2-3% ABV, fruit wines a little bit stronger, but probably no more than like 5 or 6. And so most of the benefits that I look at with alcohol come at a certain level of inebriation. That's about 0.08 blood alcohol content, about 2 beers in. Right, where you're a little, about when you should not operate a motor vehicle is when you're getting the maximum kind of creativity boost and pro-social stuff. If you're drinking a 2-3% ABV beer, you could drink that all day long and never get beyond 0.08. It's just, the volume of liquid you would have to consume to get more drunk than that is impossible. And so that made alcoholic beverages safer. There is a limit to how drunk you can get on them. When you invent distillation on a large scale, this is something I didn't realize until I started doing the research for the book. It's a very recent thing. So in Europe, we didn't have distilled liquors on a large scale until like the 1600s. So, I'm telling a story that starts 10 million years ago with our primate ancestors.
Yeah. I mean, it was 400 years in 13,000 year history, right?
Yeah. It's like yesterday. So distillation removes that safety feature because, you pull off the alcohol and you concentrate it, and then you could get, 90-something percent vodkas and gins. And those are so much more, it's such a much more dangerous form of alcohol. We're not physiologically equipped to deal with it. It completely overwhelms our physiology. You can do shots of tequila and blow right past 0.08 into really dangerous levels of inebriation where you could, you know, pass out, you could stop breathing in half an hour. If you're focused on it,
or less, if you're good at what you're doing.
Yeah. So it's an unprecedentedly dangerous form of alcohol. And then you combine that with the fact that historically drinking has always been a social activity. And in fact, in most cultures, you did not have private access to alcohol. You had alcohol drinking always happened in public in a group setting. And when we're drinking in a group setting, we have all these techniques, both explicit ritual techniques. So, you know, who's allowed to make a toast or, you know, when we're allowed to get a new round. And these informal ways where we make eye contact with each other or, you know, I've moved the bottle of wine a little bit farther away from you because you've been helping yourself a little bit too liberally. We have all these ways of kind of helping each other drink more moderately when we're together. When I can go to a drive-through liquor store and load my SUV up with cases of vodka and then take it home and be alone in my home with distilled liquor, that's really dangerous combination. And so I call it the twin banes of modernity are distillation and isolation. The fact that we drink alone and the fact that we can drink these very dangerous forms of alcohol. So one of the take-home messages from the book is that, first of all, beer is best. I'd be happy to hear that. Again, this was It's surprising for me because I'm actually not a beer fan. I'm a wine and spirits drinker. And I've actually started drinking beer, which I've never done before, as a result of having written the book. Because in terms of a package for delivering ethanol to the brain-body system in a safe, sustainable way, is really the best technology we have, especially session ales, you know, when you're drinking kind of, you know, once you start getting into these triple IPAs that are whatever, 11, 12%, you're starting to get into dangerously strong alcohols. But my impression talking to beer makers and people craft, I've talked to a lot of craft brewing associations, is that there's been a movement, you know, for a while, everyone was just, let's push it as far as we can go, make the most alcoholic beers we can. And it seems like at a certain point, people are like, well, why are we doing that? And actually the main reason you want to drink beer is to hang out with your friends and have it taste good. And so it seems like there's a movement more towards session ales and kind of lower ABV that are more like the kind of drinks we had in our evolutionary history. So it is, beer is the best form of alcohol in terms of combination of functional benefits and safety.
Well, and I think about, you know, a couple of nights ago, I opened up a strong Russian Imperial Stout, barrel aged, had lactose in it. It was just this monster of a beer. And I drank half of it, and that kind of took me to a little bit further along the path than I normally go.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Then I had the other half another night, and that took me a little further on the path. And it's like, oh, that's not the experience I want. And with all the stuff I do with this, I mean, with some exception, I preach quality over quantity, but when we have these wonderful session ales, well, we can have more of that quality.
Yeah.
we can add quantity and quality, and just life is that much better. But with all the stuff that we talked about, I mean, we talked about, you know, the dangers of it, and most of us listening and watching know the dangers of it. And then there's a cultural benefit, a evolutionary benefit to it as well. And we talked about religion, you know, the Bible, it's for it, it's against it. Where is the sweet spot? Where is that perfect balance of, because, and before I let you answer the question, I think about all the people that have come onto the podcast. They usually talk about some benefit of it. And I think about a world where, you know, to live, to survive, we don't need flavor in our food. We just need nutrition. We don't need color. We don't need music. We don't need art. We just need to survive, and we need to, you know, move about our day. That's all we need. But what kind of life is that? That just sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone I talk to is just, like I said, beer's that thing that no one needs, but everyone wants because it's a life enhancer. Mm-hmm. So now to land my plane, where is that sweet spot between burden and blessing when it comes to beer or alcohol?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a boring answer. It's just in moderation and in company, right? You want to drink with other people. You want to drink in social settings. You want to drink in an inclusive environment that involves you know, different ages, old people, young people. You want to include food. This is historically how we've always consumed alcohol. So I think if you've got, you know, I talk in the book about Southern versus Northern drinking cultures. So, and this is referring to Europe. So Northern drinking cultures focus on distilled liquors. They drink to get drunk. They drink in single sex groups, you know, typically a bunch of guys drinking together. It's forbidden to children. It's kind of a taboo thing. In cultures like that, you have a lot of problem drinking. You have really high alcoholism rates. If you look at Southern cultures like Italy, alcohol is consumed. It's all beers and wines. There's small amount of distilled liquor as an aperitivo or digestivo, but very small amounts at the beginning or end of the meal. To get visibly drunk is considered shameful. So if you slur your words or you stumble, people are embarrassed by you. It's shameful to get visibly drunk. Kids are introduced to alcohol at an early age, so kids mm-hmm. get a little bit of watered down wine at the dinner table. You drink only around the meal table. You don't drink away from the meal table. Mm. All this package of cultural practices seems to be protective as well. So if you look at Italy, for instance, very high per capita alcohol consumption, but very low alcoholism rates. And it's got to be because of these cultural practices. And I haven't been able to track down this reference, but I remember reading a really nice study that looked at compared Italians to Italian Americans, like one, two generations removed. Okay. And it's great because it controls for genetics, right? These are genetically the same people. But you move them to America, which has a northern drinking culture, right? Hard liquor, drink to get drunk. And immediately all the protective stuff goes away and they start having similar alcoholism rates to other Americans. So it seems to be the cultural practices that are important. So there are ways to, you know, there are cultures you can emulate if you want to use alcohol safely. There are cultures that can serve as models for you.
Well, and I think about Italy. I think about Spain in particular. I think about, you know, maybe even France for that matter too. But
yeah, but they're all Southern cultures.
Yeah, it's a culinary experiential pursuit. Not just a "hey, y'all, watch this" type of mentality,
it's also integrated. It's like co-evolved with the food, right? So wines and beers have co-evolved in areas with the type of cuisine they make, and so it's all this cultural package that goes together.
Well, and that's the perfect segue to my next question: is from your lens of looking at beer as a culture and stuff like that. How would you define, and how would you, if you were in charge, how would you create an ideal beer drinking experience?
Yeah. Low ABV. So back to kind of more traditional style beers, 3-5% max, have food, all around the meal table, people together, mixed groups, you know, kind of pub culture. And you think about pub culture, and ideally in Britain, where you've got, you know, these locals, where it's someplace that everyone in the neighborhood goes there, young people go there on dates, old people hang out and read the newspaper, have a pint, something where there's social support, you're socializing, you're you're keeping your ties to your community strong, and you're simultaneously getting these other benefits like stress reduction, creativity enhancement. So just any kind of culture where you're drinking beer in moderation and with other people, and well integrated with the type of food you're eating. It's kind of seamless whole.
And so that's perfect, because everything I've been trying to, I'm going to use the word preach with this work, is in line with what you just said. So thank you for that validation. And if anyone doubted me, we heard it from the professor himself. So just to kind of wind things down a little bit, I've got some fun questions that if you've listened to the podcast before, you'll know what's coming. If you haven't, then this will be fun. But tomorrow, you get to be king of the entire beer world for one day. What would you change? What's one thing you would change?
What would I change about beer? I think I would get rid of the crazy triple IPA, maximum alcohol content nonsense, and dial things back to a level that is pleasant to drink, that tastes good and sustainable, that you can have more than one of without getting dangerously intoxicated. I think there was a weird, I'm not a beer person, so I really have kind of a vague sense of it, but I do get the impression that there was this push to just go maximum alcohol, maximum hops.
Yeah.
And it seems like it was a dead end in a way. It led to some interesting beers, but you want balance.
Yeah. It's funny that at least within the American craft, I can't speak outside as well, but there was a cycle where we were pushing for that double, that triple, that bourbon barrel aged blah 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 12%, 14%. I've had a beer that was 16.9%, and
that's,
it was just
crazy. 16.9,
but wow. It was intense. It was bigger than a wine. It was just it was incredible. I'm glad I tried it, but I still ask the question why. And then of course with the cycle, we respond, and now it's all about low alcohol and no alcohol, and it's just back and forth. It'd be nice to just kind of hold the line and have just a few options. But some of that stuff is just like, hey, check me out, look what I can do.
It's technical expertise for its own sake rather than producing something.
And sometimes we need to blow off a whole lot of steam. So that's where the triple IPA comes in, I guess. But
yeah.
So at the end of your royal day, we're going to send you anywhere on earth to have a meal and a beer of your choice. Where would you go and what would you have?
Ooh. Again, I'm not a beer drinker, so I'm masquerading as someone who loves beer for scientific reasons. Dissing triple IPAs. I like IPAs.
Just a single IPA.
I had an IPA at the craft, that conference you saw me speak at. Yeah. That was really good. I'm trying to remember now what it was, but it was a kind of more traditional style IPA. I think that on a sunny patio somewhere with some fish and chips or fish tacos would be my ideal meal.
All right.
It's actually kind of making me hungry right now.
I know. So yeah. I know. Yeah. It's almost, we're getting there. It's almost happy hour.
All right.
And again, I appreciate you sharing that you're not primarily a beer person, but it's nice to see that you're on our team on occasion. So translate this question as you see fit, but the question nonetheless is, why does Good Beer matter so much to you?
So for all these functional reasons I've mentioned, and that's what the bulk of the book is about. At the end of the book, I also point out that alcohol makes us feel good and it tastes good and that should matter. So it can't be part of the evolutionary story, because the positive functions have to be something that's functional, that makes sense in terms of the currency that evolution cares about. but we are not our genes, and we like pleasure. And so I really just think that the complexity and the texture of taste that you can get with a really nice wine and with some of these complex beers I was tasting at the Dead Craft Beer Festival. Humans want beauty, we want complexity, we want taste. We can't live on just bread and water, even though physiologically maybe we could. For the same reason that we want beautiful things to look at and we want beautiful music to listen to, we want beautiful, complex beers and wines to drink. And they enhance our lives in a way that isn't captured by the evolutionary story that I'm telling in the bulk of the book.
Yeah. Well, another big question I have too is you know, in recent conversations with other colleagues in the beer industry, we talk about this younger generation that's just entering legal beer drinking age. They're drinking seltzers, they're drinking cocktails in a can, they're drinking anything and everything. What advice do you have for these new drinkers coming into the world of alcohol or the world of beer?
Moderation. Again, boring story, right? Yeah. You know, quality and moderation. Low ABV beers that have some complexity that you can savor and share with others. That seems to be the path to go.
Gotcha. Perfect. So if anyone wants to reach out to you or not reach out to you, but like find your book or your website, where could they go?
I have a website, edwardslayerland.com, that's got more than you would ever want to know about various books, podcasts, yeah, and things like that. That's great.
Yeah, I did a lot of research there. It was wonderful. And any last words you want to share?
Beer is best, which is, I've found, but it's where I was led by the science. So I think that that's something the beer industry should be more self-aware about.
Gotcha. Well, I absolutely agree. And I'm sure everyone listening, watching feel the same way. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Thank you for the work that you're doing. It's endlessly fascinating. I think we need to know more of it. So anyone listening, watching, go get the book Drunk and read it or listen to it. It's fantastic. But thank you for being here. I appreciate your time and your knowledge.
Thanks for having me. All right. A lot of fun.
I tell people that beer is something no one needs, but everyone wants. Would you agree? I don't condone abusing alcohol, but it does serve a purpose. So how do we find the sweet spot of benefit over burden and quality over quantity? Moderation is the common answer. What's yours? In the next episode, we head to Northern Europe to a country not necessarily known for its beer, but we learn why it should be. I'm on a virtual tour of the craft and culture of beer around the globe. I've put Good Beer Matters on video so I can take you along for the ride. If you know of a person, a place, or a beer story that needs to be told, let me know. Meanwhile, grab a beer, hang out with friends, and let your world open up. Thank you for listening. Cheers.